From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to imagine it now, but when Maurice Sendak first published his children's picture book, Where the Wild Things Are, 1963, it caused quite a stir. Some critics called it pointless and confusing. Others said it was entirely inappropriate for young people. It was frightening, they said, really frightening. The scholar John Cech says the book disrupted the sensibilities of the status quo because it dared to open up the fantasies of young people and let the monsters out. Of course, many, many others loved the book, and now, nearly 50 years later, there are something like 19 million copies on bookshelves throughout the world. Maurice Sendak died yesterday. When a movie based on the book came out a few years ago, we took the opportunity to talk about Maurice Sendak's masterpiece. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting that conversation. So join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Maurice Sendak first published his child's picture book, Where the Wild Things Are, in 1963, the art critic for the New York Times said that Sendak had given shape to the fantasies of millions of children, an awful responsibility. The book has become a classic, of course, with something like 19 million copies published in more than a dozen languages. But in 1963, the book was seen as shocking, even provocative, because it had darkened the calm and sunny picture of childhood. The book is only 30 or so pages, 10 sentences. It's the story of Max, who, after being sent to his room for misbehaving, goes off to where the wild things are. A few years ago, when the film version of the book, directed by Spike Jonze, had just opened, we talked about the book and the movie. Maurice Sendak, of course, died yesterday at the age of 83, so we're taking the opportunity to rebroadcast our conversation about Where the Wild Things Are. Joining us first was NPR's Bob Mondello. He's, of course, the film critic for All Things Considered. And when they make movies from books these days, he said they tend to reinvent them completely.
There was Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yeah.
And that story doesn't have a story. It's just kind of things are falling out of the sky, and so they had to invent something for it. And so they invented a backstory for the whole thing, which is kind of interesting. And it's a little bit what they did with this one, too. Spike Jonze is a really imaginative director. I mean, he's famous for Adaptation and for Being John Malkovich, both of which were the strangest pictures you've ever seen for adults. I mean, just really weird. Inside the head of John Malkovich, hundreds and hundreds of John Malkoviches running around. So this one is a very... It's an unorthodox approach to the story. It starts out with this whole backstory created for the little boy.
Yeah.
Max has a sister now, and in addition to a mom, and she's kind of ignoring him, and Max is running around the house. And there are very specific things that, he's a child of divorce, apparently.
Yeah.
Mom has a new boyfriend. These sort of things distress him. And there's a big snowball fight in the front that is, you know, I came to this book, I should just say, 13 days ago. I wasn't born in 1962, and I don't have any children, so I didn't get a chance to read this to them. This book was not part of my growing up, but none of that. I read it just before I went to the movie, which took, you know, a minute and a half.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, there's not. I mean, it is literally 10 sentences.
Yeah, yeah.
And admired the drawings, but I realized, you know, from looking at it, okay, they're going to have to do some work here. This will last 4 minutes,
right.
You know, and they've really done quite a bit. It's really imaginative. It's really clever. And all of the things, you know, the monsters running around, the wild things in the forest sort of have been tied to the invented story that they've got at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
And for instance, my favorite transformation is there's this snowball fight that ends up crashing an igloo in the beginning of the thing, and that turns into a dirt clod fight.
Yeah.
With the monsters. Well, there are parallels for almost everything. I think you can find each of the characters in the monsters, and that's really how dreams work, right?
Yeah.
That's how we imagine things especially when we're children.
So do we have to concede that the experience of a book and a movie, they're different, and that if you loved the book, you kind of have to let that go somewhat if you're going to experience the film. You have to experience it in some ways in a different way.
Oh, sure. The worst thing that you can do is go into a film and expect it to work the same way a book does. It simply doesn't. The whole narrative process is different. And, if they really did duplicate the book on screen, it would be really annoying. it would kind of be, okay, why am I here? And yeah. I imagined it better. And, there's no point to that. So you kind of have to rework it. And if it's a complicated plot, then you have to pare it down and leave things out, which will upset people who are sort of, enamored of the book. And then if it doesn't have a plot like this one, then you've got the opposite problem. You kind of have to invent things. I think the inventions in this case are really fascinating. Now, I'm not, the critical fraternity is not unanimous in that.
No.
Ken Turan on Morning Edition didn't like this at all.
At all? Can I read what he said?
Sure.
He said that the film is a self-indulgent cinematic misfire that neither parents nor children are going to like. I mean, he didn't like it at all.
And I called it a work of cinematic art.
That's right.
So this is proof that people can disagree about the arts. And I think in this case, this movie, look, it did pretty well in its opening weekend, not fabulously, but it did pretty well. And I think there seemed to be a sense among people in general, when I was talking to them this here at NPR, at least, that people had liked the picture. It's kind of not for 5-year-olds,
yeah.
Right? And 5-year-olds are who you would normally show it to as a child. So it's not running around enough. You know, there are slow patches in it. It's an interesting, thoughtful movie. So I think it's more for slightly older children and for adults who are kind of crazy about the book and think that it, maybe there was more there than they got from it originally.
Let's play a clip from the film. At this point, because I want to have you talk about this. It's interesting when you imagine the voice of a monster, this may not be what you get. At this point, Max has arrived at the place where the wild things are, and he's introduced to one of the monsters, this one in this clip, named KW, voiced by the actor Lauren Ambrose.
Mm-hmm. I'm KW.
I'm Max.
So what's your story? Why'd you come here?
Well, I'm an explorer, and I traveled a lot. And I travel by sea.
Right.
I used to travel by air.
So obviously you have no home or family.
I have one of those, but...
But you ate them all?
No. No, I just bit one of them, that's all, and it went crazy. And I don't like frozen corn.
I'm sorry. That's why you left.
You act like I'm a bad person.
Well, are you?
I don't know.
Well, I'm glad you came. It'll be good to have someone around who doesn't eat everybody. I mean, you just bite everyone. But biters aren't so bad. Eaters are the ones I just can't stand.
I have no plans to eat anybody.
All right. Good. Well, good night.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like what you would think a monster would sound, and I guess that's part of the conceit for this film, right?
Right. And the person who is the monster who is sort of, let me think how to say it, is sort of Max's alter ego in this world, is played by James Gandolfini, or voiced by James Gandolfini. And that's also a voice that you might not associate with monsters. And I think, no, these are kind of adult voices, and the concerns in it are his concerns voiced in a rational and sort of sensible way, for the most part. And it makes sense that a kid would see adults as monsters, or at least it makes sense to me looking back at it. I mean, they're huge. There's a one of the things they make it a point to show you, and it's a lovely moment in the very beginning of the picture. At one point, Max is playing under the desk as his mother is writing, and he tugs at her stocking you know, at her stockinged foot and just pulls it at the toe. And you realize all of a sudden when you're looking at that, that for a child, when a child looks at the world, everybody's a monster. Everybody's huge. And it's just such a child's eye view of things. And then when you get to this other world, you get to play with the monsters. And the monsters, you know, they don't hurt you, but, you know, they're still a little scary. And it's, I think it's a very sort of real world way of looking, or real child's world way of looking at adults. And so it makes sense that monsters would be adults.
You know, for those who didn't like it, didn't seem to like that part of it. I mean, David Denby, for example, in The New Yorker, and Kenneth Turan, for that matter, you know, they were thinking that the monsters were too human, too neurotic, is how I think Turan put it. Like, the, I think he said that was something like it was like a group therapy session from an alternate universe. But you liked that about it, it seems.
Oh, I liked it a lot. Yeah. And actually, we found tape of Maurice Sendak talking to, I think it was Terry Gross, about how he had originally come up with the monsters. Mm. And they were all his Jewish relatives when he was growing up.
We have that clip. You want to hear it?
Oh, I'd love to. It's a great bit.
Yeah, yeah. Here it is. This is Maurice Sendak, again, with from the program Fresh Air from Terry Gross.
I didn't want them to be traditional monsters, like griffins and gorillas and such like. I wanted them to be very, very personal. I had to come out of my own particular life. And I remember it took a very long time until that gestation occurred and where they began to appear on drawing paper and they began to be what I liked. And it was only when I had them all that I realized they were all my Jewish relatives. They were all the adults who treated us in such silly fashions when we were kids. And these were the real monsters of my childhood. You know, people come on Sunday and wait to get fed, uncles and aunts, and they all say the same dumb thing while you're beating time till food gets put on the table, how big you are and how fat you got, and you look so good we can eat you up. In fact, we knew they would because my mother was the slowest cooker in Brooklyn, so if she didn't hurry up, they would eat us up. So the only entertainment was watching their bloodshot eyes and how bad their teeth were. You know, children are monstrously cruel about physical defects. You know, the hair curling out of the nose and the weird mole on the side of the head. And so you would glue in on that and then you'd talk about it with your brother and sister later. And they became the Wild Things.
Hmm. It's great to hear him talk about that. It seems to make a lot of sense.
We'll have to play that for Kenny Turan.
That's right.
I think he's absolutely right at that. That is how kids see adults. Yeah. I just think it makes sense. Thank heaven they eventually grow out of it sometime after the teenage years, I think.
What'd you think about Max Records? I mean, he hadn't done, I don't think, much acting or any acting before this film.
Yeah, he hasn't done much, and he's extraordinary. He's so natural as a kid. You look at him, and he looks wide-eyed at times. He's completely authentic. I kept thinking it must be neat to play with those great big, the Jim Henson creatures. Mm-hmm. But he looks at them as if they are absolutely real. You never question anything that he does on screen. And that's remarkable. I mean, Spike Jonze, who I've thought of as a director of adults all this time, just got a fabulous performance out of him. You know, on the web someplace, there is I saw this the other day, there is a screen test for a younger child, a 5-year-old, for this part. And you look at that screen test and you think, oh my goodness, it would have been a completely different picture.
Wow.
If they had gone with that. That Max Records has already grown up enough to be able to wrestle with things that it would have, with a 5-year-old, it would have had to have been a child's picture, right? And with I guess whatever he is, he's like 11, I think.
Nine,
something like that. He's old enough to be able to wrestle with things intellectually. Yeah. And so he's playing, and emotionally, he's playing with a lot of ideas in the picture.
Bob Mondello, he's the film critic for NPR's All Things Considered. He joined us in 2009 when Spike Jonze's film Where the Wild Things Are was out in theaters. Writer and illustrator Maurice Sendak died yesterday at the age of 83. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. Mm-hmm. 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 This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Where the Wild Things Are, the book that changed children's literature when it first came out in 1963. Yesterday, the writer and illustrator Maurice Sendak died at the age of 83, so we're rebroadcasting our conversation about the book. Children's literature scholar John Check joined us. He teaches at the University of Florida, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Children's Literature and Culture. Check says that today, it's hard to imagine the impact the book had when it was first released in 1963.
It was, in its own way, a really revolutionary book. It comes at a time in American cultural history, just before, a few years before the Summer of Peace and Love, as we call it today. Mm-hmm. But a kind of breakthrough moment in cultural history when suddenly we become interested in childhood, and childhood as a kind of important place for artists and writers and for adults to be thinking about. And of course, there had been millions of children's books before that point, but Sendak caught something that was in the zeitgeist at the time in the 1960s, yeah. And was able to and that book spoke to people about what was happening, and in terms of our thinking about children and childhood and the emotional lives of childhood. Yeah. And one of the things that we forget about Sendak when we celebrate him for having done Wild Things in 63 was that he'd written about or worked on about 50 books prior to that point as a young illustrator. Really groundbreaking books in their own right. His first book was called A Hole is to Dig that he did with Ruth Krauss, and it was based on children's first definitions of things. And he worked with very small pen and ink drawings, and he did drawings of children that he was familiar with from growing up in Brooklyn, kids, in fact, that he had observed across the street from him as he was a young artist and sketching them. Kids from every ethnicity, and very unlike the kind of stereotypical children we were meeting in American children's books. And then as the decade progressed, he gave these children an inner life, increasingly in a series of haunting and funny, dreamlike, and fresh books, constantly inventing new ways to do things. Just about everything he touched from the 1950s on was just, you know, it's so unique. His style was changing. He was bringing in people like Marc Chagall or Winslow Homer. You name the artist that he probably has appeared in Maurice's books in those early years, and he continued to do that in his later years. And he was so concerned with what was going on inside the minds and hearts and souls of children. Mm. And I think for some adults, many adults, this is a bit of a wake-up call. I mean, they've forgotten what it was like, you know, to be Max and to go into a tantrum like that, to invent this fantasy world to cope with it. And these fantasies are a little bit off-putting to adults.
Yeah.
We don't quite know what to do with them. You know?
There's a great quote that you have in your book from Ursula Nordstrom, who helped him edit the book. And she wrote to him, she wrote this, that it's always the adults we have to contend with. Most children, she writes, under the age of 10, will react creatively to the best work of a truly creative person. But too often the adults, she says, sift their reaction to creative picture books through their own adult experience.
Right. Right, absolutely. And I think part of what's happening now with this whole thing, whether these monsters are going to scare children and so forth, it's in part what a few critics said when the book came out in 63. You know, one British critic famously said, don't allow your children in this book to be left alone in a dimly lit room because it might cause irreversible psychological damage. And then a number of years after the book had come out, the famous child psychiatrist Bruno Bettelheim had condemned it. And because, not so much because of the frightening nature of it, but because of the punishment of Max being sent to his room without his supper. You know, Bettelheim would later recant and would, in fact, absorb a lot of what Maurice was doing and use that to write his famous book, Bettelheim's famous book about fairy tales, The Uses of Enchantment. I mean, I see that as being directly related to what Where the Wild Things Are opened up to him. In terms of these powerful fantasies that children in Sendak's books, for sure, but in many other places, master through their own imaginations.
Were kids supposed to have fantasies? I mean, that seemed like that was something that seemed to disturb people, that they weren't supposed to have fantasies. They were kids.
Yeah, exactly. And if they did, they were sort of like Dr. Seuss fantasies, like the cat in the hat. And you get this incredible mayhem that's created in the house while mom's away. And at the end, the kids are left to wonder, you know, should we tell her that the cat was here or not? And they decide not to tell her.
Yeah.
And this was true in Seuss's first book, and to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, which came out in the 30s, about this little boy who's coming home from school, and he imagines this incredible Seussian contraption, and he gets home, and his dad is there reading the paper, and his dad said, "Did anything happen at school today?" You know, and the boy stops and thinks, and you can tell what he's thinking is, he'll never get it.
Yeah.
And he decides not to tell his father what he's thinking.
Right.
And I think Maurice really brought that to the fore in American children's books. I mean, he truly let the cat out of the bag. I mean, he didn't opt for, you know, don't tell the folks because, you know, it'll spook them sort of thing that Dr. Seuss had done. I mean, he tells the story. He tells the fantasies.
Let's go to the phone. Dan is with us, calling from Salt Lake City. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I love the show. Just a couple comments. I loved the book when I was little. I'm a Mexican immigrant from Mexico, and I used it actually to learn English. So
wow.
It was. I was super excited when I heard it was going to be a movie. Although I was kind of at first disappointed because I thought that it was monsters with emotional issues. But after I had time to reflect on it, I thought it was very wonderfully done because it allows us to not just children, but for us adults to understand how is it that we're making sense of the world. So I thought it was fascinating, not only that the music was awesome, but it was very well done. And I'm 27, and I can take some really good things from it now that I've reflected on it.
Huh. John Cech, it's interesting that the movie, as you sort of referred to this earlier, it's been criticized for frightening children, which is exactly what people were saying about the book at the time.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the articles that's been going around, I guess Sendak did an interview with Newsweek in which he more or less told the parents to, you know, let go of that whole idea that this might frighten kids. A lot of things frighten children. I mean, and Sendak has said this over the years, you know, and if we think of our own experience or if we have children or our experience as children, all sorts of things frightened us. Creaky boards and the dog next door and, you know, I mean, you cannot spare children from fear in their lives. You can spare them from big fears, huge fears, and outrageous fears, but this doesn't rank among them.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about the book, if you look at it really closely, is you see from the very beginning of the book that Max has these monsters under control.
Right.
So if you're paying attention to the picture book, as young kids are when they're seeing it and looking at it for the first time, and every time that they see it, they know that Max is going to tame the wild things. Sendak shows you that on the title page. So there's really no reason to bite your nails and worry over whether he's ever going to get out of it. But fairy tales, you know, have had that rap laid against them, too, that they're going to frighten kids. And I think Bettelheim and other psychologists have made an, you know, I think say something really important is that in the form of a story, a frightening story, there is containment.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, in children's books where there are, you know, upsetting or frightening things, they're contained within the story. And generally, I can't think of many examples where this doesn't happen. You'd have to go up into young adult literature or adult literature to see it. But generally, the monsters are tamed, whatever those monsters are.
Right.
The books end happily, even though there are precarious moments.
Dan, thanks very much. Here's an email from CK who writes, "I read the book to my son when he was four, The illustrations are fabulous. The story, wonderful. My son loved it and enjoyed the scariness of the story. Let's face it, kids love to be scared. I know I did when I was small.
There you go.
Yeah. CK says, I saw the trailers for the movie. The costumes look like the illustrations. I hope to see this movie with or without my 19-year-old son. CK, thanks very much for that. Let's go back to the phones. Gloria is with us in Salt Lake. Gloria, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking me.
Sure.
I just have to say I took my 8-year-old granddaughter Molly and her friend. We all loved it. The music's beautiful. They weren't frightened. They thought the characters were so real. The voices, and James Gandolfini did a fabulous job. The animals in the movie were just like in the book. In fact, we came home, we reread the book, and now I plan on taking my husband. It was great.
Is that wonderful?
We thoroughly enjoyed it.
Let's hope he's not frightened.
I hope not.
Yeah, it's the adults you have to worry about.
I know, that's true.
Yeah. Gloria, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So, John, I'm surprised, I guess, that you haven't seen the movie yet.
Well, I'm going to be seeing it next week. I'll see it. In fact, this weekend with my grandson and see what he thinks of it. And then I'm on a panel talking about the film next week, and it involves the screening. And I thought I'd see it fresh so that I will be, I guess, at the place where a lot of the people are in the audience if they have questions about it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I've been holding off seeing it. Mostly because I have the flu. So that's been keeping me away from the movie theaters.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. James is with us in Salt Lake City. James, hi.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Hi.
Actually had the opportunity to work with Maurice a small number of years ago in New York City when I was working there. He had designed a backdrop for a company called Palabolas for their dance called A Selection. It was a rather tricky to fit it into my small theater in New York City and difficult to light, and he was very patient and supportive through the entire process. A really, really sweet, wonderful man, very kind, very gentle, and he actually signed my copy of the book with a nice little doodle of one of the creatures in it.
Wow.
And it's one of my prized possessions.
Yeah, it should be.
Yeah, that's a treasure. Yeah. Yeah, he is that. He's really wonderful. And I think what it's such a testament, this film, you know, because a lot of people hold on to their books. They don't want it. They don't want them, you know, converted into films. They don't want them tampered with in any way, or they resent that when that happens. And Maurice has been just so generous with Spike Jonze and Dave Eggers and the people who've worked on this project and his time and advice. And but really, more than anything else, turning it loose, telling them to make it their own. I mean, that's very unusual. You don't normally hear that from authors, just releasing the book into the world in that way.
Mm. James, thanks very much. Back to the phones now. Kim is with us, calling from Ogden. Kim, welcome.
Hi, Doug. I just had a comment. I had read something by the author of Roald Dahl, author of The Witches, and
Charlie
I don't know
the Chocolate Factory.
How close contemporaries they were. But anyway, he had said something in response to his critics who had said, you know, these books are too frightening for children and they're in peril constantly. But he had said something the effect that children do like to be scared, and they sort of see the horrific side of life, and their imaginations are thinking of these things anyway.
Yeah.
And it sort of is giving validity to their aptitude for sort of a bloodlust that they have anyway.
Yeah,
oh, that's such a good quote. I mean, Sendak talks about, in his Caldecott acceptance speech for the book, watching a group of kids on the street, you know, sort of performing this ritual in which one kid becomes the monster and scares all the other kids, just terrorizes them. And he's so into the role, and he's screaming and yelling at them and gnashing his teeth and waving his yellow claws around and whatever. And they all stop breathlessly, panting on the stoop, and it's a hot summer day, and, you know, they're exhausted. And then one kid says, "Do it again! Do it again!" And they go into this into this performance space where one child is the monster and he's scaring all the other kids, and they're taking great delight in it.
Mm-hmm. So. The relationship between Roald Dahl's work and Maurice Sendak, do you see something there? They both seemed to have little patience for people kind of pandering to children, that kids were, you know, could be nasty creatures themselves, or certainly could be.
In Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, we should remember that he kills one of them off.
Yeah.
He what's her name? She sends her down the chute in the candy factory. Right. I don't think we don't ever see her again in the book.
Yeah, is there a relationship between those two writers, do you think? Their sensibilities in some ways?
Well, I think in terms of that willingness to really live and have their characters and their works live inside the experience of children, I think they're very close. I mean, their works are very different, and in many ways their sensibilities are very different. But something that unites them is the frankness with which they approach the emotional lives of childhood, the content of childhood. They don't shy away from it. And other writers, too, are like that as well. I mean, J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan, was remarkable for his insights into the way children work. And not all of Peter Pan is, it isn't all Tinkerbell and fairy dust and everything else. It's very edgy and dark in many places in that classic.
Kim, glad you called. Thanks very much. In that Caldecott acceptance speech, Sendak also talked about this need for children to invent what he called a collection of necessary games.
Yeah.
What did he mean?
Well, psychologically we might call these coping devices, I suppose. But he had spent, as a young artist, a whole summer, he said, watching children across the street playing a series of games that one of them in particular, a little girl named Rosie, invented for all the kids to play. And these were games that brought out, problems in her life and metaphorically stated those things in the forms of these playlets that they acted out on the stoops of Brooklyn. But they were also part of their fantasy lives. She was able to capture what these kids wanted and what they were dreaming about as they were, living their lives out in on the stoops of Brooklyn. So kids do find ways that they cope. They find ways to places they can go to solve whatever those emotional problems that they're facing are. And it might be theater for some, playing for others, drawing for kids like Sendak, who worked through a lot of things, it seems, as a child and as an adult. Sendak has a book called Fantasy Sketches that he was drawing during the 1950s, where he would simply put on a piece of music, and then he would make drawings, very quick drawings that would circle the page. And some of these are very surprising, and he decided, he said at the beginning, not to censor himself at all in terms of what he drew. And so he might have a child, shooting it. There's a famous one, in fact, that caught a lot of attention, where this little kid gets so mad at his mother that he pulls out a pistol and shoots her. In the comic strip, I should say.
Yeah.
Kids have fantasies that, and we all do, because we all pass through this. This stage in our psychological development, where we have sometimes extreme fantasies. We wish that somebody who we really don't like was no longer there. And it's surprising to see those sorts of things, because we generally think of Sendak's work as being, really appropriate, and this was work for his adult self, as we might call it, and it was very surprising and unexpected, and in its the extremes of its emotions. But that was the point of it: is what's going on inside of us, and how do we state that? What kinds of mechanisms do we find for ventilating that, catharting that, finding ways to relieve ourselves, unburden ourselves of these emotional, these big emotional things that are happening in our lives. And for him, for kids, with vis-a-vis children, it's fantasy. It's the place that you can go to that no one can punish you in, and no one can yell at you in, and where you are in control of what ultimately happens there. And in The Night Kitchen, the big picture book that followed Where the Wild Things Are, and Outside Over There, the book that followed Night Kitchen, I mean, he was working with this theme of how kids manage, how characters, creative characters, manage to deal with these issues.
Here's an email from Edward, who writes, Where the Wild Things Are was one of the stories that I've held dear since my own childhood 30 years ago. I have a 5-year-old son and a girl due in March, and Where the Wild Things Are will be on both of their bookshelves. And in fact, I've taken upon myself to provide this book to all the children I know, friends, family, etc.
That's wonderful.
John Check. He teaches at the University of Florida and directs the Center for the Study of Children's Literature and Culture. We're going to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the children's picture book, Where the Wild Things Are, which was first published in 1963. The author and illustrator, Maurice Sendak, died yesterday. We spoke with John Check about the book. He directs the Center for the Study of Children's Literature and Culture at the University of Florida. He joined us in 2009 when Where the Wild Things Are was made into a feature film. Here's an email from Art, who writes, For many years, the annual Pacific Northwest Ballet performance of The Nutcracker used sets and characters designed by Sendak, adapted from Where the Wild Things Are. I'm not sure if they're still being used, but it added, Art writes, a whole new level of meaning to Tchaikovsky's classic, another exploration of the fearsome adventure that is childhood. Do people do that, John Check, sort of use Sendak for other... other things, you know,
oh my gosh, I was just looking on the web. Just if I urge everyone listening just to take a couple of minutes if they love to do some surfing online and just Google in Where the Wild Things Are and do an image search. And you will get everything from there's a whole series of bento box lunches that have been made of the wild things,
right.
Using rice and, you know, various forms of edibles to recreate the wild things. There are now costumes of the wild things that adults can buy. One company's brought them out to mark the premiere. There are a number of stores that are carrying wild things paraphernalia and shadow puppets, and the whole merchandising aspect of it is certainly there. Jewelry, faux fur vests and dresses and all sorts of things. So there's I think a real fan base for this movie. I mean, people are so excited about it that designers have been busy making new things, wild things inspired things for people to wear to celebrate the movie and this kind of cultural rediscovery of it. It's really interesting. When I was doing my book about Sendak, I would ask people about Where the Wild Things Are. I'd ask them, actually, if they knew who Maurice Sendak was, and they didn't. And then I would ask them if they knew Where the Wild Things Are, and they would say, oh, that's the book about the monsters.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, yeah, we know that. But they didn't know who Sendak was. And in a way, what it suggested to me was that this story and these images were so powerful that they made their way into our collective consciousness without our needing to know who actually invented them. Huh. I mean, it's good to know that, and I think we should ultimately. But it had joined sort of like the Ugly Duckling, which a lot of people don't realize was actually written by someone. But most people know the story, but they don't know Anderson wrote it today.
Yeah.
So, and I think Wild Things is, if it hasn't already, it certainly will probably in the next 10 or 15 or 20 or 50 years have developed that kind of canonical, iconic status where it's just there as part of the culture.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Sally is with us, calling from Logan, Utah. Sally, welcome.
Hi. I love the book, Where the Wild Things Are, and just recently saw the movie. And as a mother, I found that, you know, Maurice Sendak was very responsible in how he had Max sent to his room where he could fantasize in a safe place. And in the movie, Max bites his mother and then runs out of the house and down the street and climbs into a boat. And I found that very irresponsible of the filmmakers, and I guess that's just my comment.
Huh. It's interesting, John Cech, that we don't see the mother, at least not until I guess he creates a mother in 1985 when he creates the book as an opera. Yeah.
For the opera version of it. Yeah. Well, I think that's a really interesting comment, and in fact, if you look at there's a book that's come out about the making of The Wild Things called Heads On and We Shoot, the making of Where the Wild Things Are, by the editors of McSweeney, Spike Jonze, Dave Eggers. And what they say is that one of the only real issues that they had in discussing moving the story from book to film with Sendak was whether it should happen in the room, and the room should transform as it does in the book. Which is what Maurice wanted to happen, evidently, from their description in the book. And they're feeling that the boy should run away. And this, in order to make this whole experience more dramatic. And Spike Jonze and Dave Eggers argued with Maurice that if you don't have him run away, people know that it's all in his head and that he's going to solve the problem, and there's no edge to the drama at all. And I guess this dispute went on for quite a while, and it was the only point where they really disagreed. And finally, Maurice said, "Well, sure, you know, it's your film," and they went ahead and did it this way.
Are you ready to prepared? I guess John Cech to hate the movie.
Well, you know, there are so few movies that I think it's kind of a false comparison, you know, ask that the movie hold for us what the book did. Because when we read a book, or look at a picture book, we're making everything up. We're making up a soundtrack. We're making up how these characters' voices are, you know, the pacing of their voices and all of these things, or our parents are, or somebody is. Or it's in our heads, and we're bound to be disappointed by what happens on the screen, because it's not going to be what we imagined it to be, and this is, you know, 99.99% of the cases. The only instance where I can think of, or a number of them, where that they've tried to hew so closely to the movie or to the book, the movie has. As to be almost indistinguishable, are the Harry Potter films.
Yeah.
You know, that have tried, because of the huge Harry Potter fan base, the directors and writers have been very, very reluctant to deviate at all from the scripts, which has been great in some cases and not so great in others. And but no matter what they've done on film, the fans of Harry Potter have not liked the films to a great extent, or loved the films but not liked huge parts of them, or whatever. I don't think that you can make the comparison. I think you almost need to see both of these things on their own terms and in separately, and not expect the book to be the film and vice versa. So I'm not prepared. I'm prepared to have the experience wash over me, you know, and have it. What happens, happens. When the first film version of the book came out in the mid-70s by Weston Woods Films, which is one of the leading producers of quality short animated films for young people, and they did an animated version of Where the Wild Things Are that was done in Czechoslovakia with Czechoslovakian animators, and they worked out these new techniques. In fact, it's interesting, it took them almost as long to make that animated movie, that 10-minute animated movie, which you can still see and still buy and get at the video stores, as it did to make this full-length feature movie, about 5 years, something like that, off and on. And when they did the film, the children's lit critics were so upset about the movie. How dare anybody, you know, take this classic, this landmark book, and transform it into a film. So I don't think this ever stops, this sort of thing where we want the film to live up to the reputation of the book.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, what was, because you write a little bit about this before it became what it did with Max, that I can't remember the title now offhand because I don't have it in front of me, Where the Wild Horses Go or something? I mean,
yeah, the book actually begins as a dummy, a small dummy book that Sendak did called Where the Wild Horses Are. And it's about a boy who goes on an adventure, and he takes a boat and gets to this, ends up at this island. Sendak said he abandoned the book because he couldn't draw horses. I would argue with him about that because I think he trusts pretty good horses, mostly pretty good at everything. And what he said since then is that when he told his editor Ursula Nordstrom that he couldn't do that, and they had discussions about what would he draw. He had been doodling on a pad, and he'd been doodling a kind of monsterish figure. And she said, "Well, what's that?" And he said, "Well, I don't know what it is. It's I don't know. It's a wild thing." And so she said, "Well, make it about that." Or they agreed, or he got the idea. I forget exactly how it happened. But it came out of a kind of a script discussion about the book. I mean, what was he going to do with it? Who were these monsters going to be? So it's a book that evolved for almost 10 years, in different forms, different shapes, and finally got to this point. And he left out a bunch of scenes, which if you make an appointment to see some of them at the Rosenbach Museum and Library, maybe you would have a chance to see some of the other sketches that weren't there, scenes that weren't included in ultimately in the book. One of which has Max up on a table eating spaghetti like a dog or a cat might out of a bowl. And the dog and the cat and his household are so horrified that they're recoiling from him. I mean, he's wilder than they are. It's interesting that this film comes back to the idea of Max being on a table, yelling at his mother.
Yeah. Do you think, let me ask you this finally, about a minute left or so, did Maurice Sendak ever worry that this book would define him? Or did he just concede, this is my masterpiece and I'm okay with that?
Well, you know, I think Maurice is, as I've known his work and followed his work over the years, he's really our Mozart of children's books, for sure. But because he does so many things, and there are any number of masterpieces in his canon, I think what he's a little bemused by is that this would be the book that gets all the attention when if you go and look at Outside Over There, for example. You know, the drawing in that book, the painting in that book is just extraordinary. Far better than Where the Wild Things Are, or different, let me put it that way. It's just different drawing. So, it's that old question that they always ask artists, you know, which is your favorite painting, or writers, which is your favorite book, you know? And Sendak has often said they're all his children, you know? And you like one better than the other, but certainly there's something that you're proud of in each one of them. And so I think he would say, if I could put words in his mouth, that there are a number of books that might be categorized as that, as a kind of masterpiece, and that this would be the only one that people seem to want to talk about would probably leave him a little bit scratching his head, but then glad for that.
John Cech, he's the author of the book Angels and Wild Things. Writer and illustrator Maurice Sendak died yesterday. He was 83. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our interns are Olivia Davis and Matthew Martin. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.